Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Good evening, everyone. If you enjoy our show and find our research both interesting and informative, please can I ask that you consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does help us out a huge amount. You can also find out more about us and our work by heading over to deadsouls.co.uk and checking us out. We are a small team of 3 researchers with more than 70 years of experience between us. You can also find us and speak to us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is The Iranian Embassy Siege, Part 2. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight.
Chapter 3, The Standoff.
Gentlemen, you are to resolve the situation, and there is to be no chance of failure. I do not want an ongoing problem beyond the embassy. May God be with you.
This is a quote from UK Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. The 1980s were a turbulent decade that saw significant change across the global order. The decade was to bear witness to the rise of Western conservatism and free market economics. With a culture shifting, socio-economic change in countries like the United States, United Kingdom, Australia, Canada, and much of Europe, and significant advances in technology, consumerism, and a worldwide step towards laissez-faire economics and growth to Western wealth. The AIDS epidemic emerged at the start of the decade and would develop into a sizable threat to global population, killing an estimated 40.4 million people to date. With the election of Ronald Reagan in the United States in 1980, the US and Great Britain moved even closer within their special relationship, sharing the same views in the economy, foreign policy, trade, and many cultural facets. Beginning in 1980, the USSR grew more and more unstable, and during the 1980s it edged closer and closer to its eventual fall at the end of the decade, and finally ending the decades-long Cold War. In the previous episode, we shared how 6 Iranian gunmen had attacked the Iranian embassy in London and taken 26 hostages. They demanded the release of almost 100 political prisoners and complete autonomy for the Khuzestan region, for which they called Arabistan. Deputy Commissioner John Dello led the Metropolitan Police response to the situation, and on day one of the incident requested the SAS be put on standby in case support was needed. The UK Ministry of Defence immediately authorised this request, and the 22 Special Air Service Regiment were quietly and invisibly deployed to London, taking position at the scene just a few hours after the crisis had begun. The Metropolitan Police began negotiations with the terrorists right away in order to de-escalate the situation. They were not aware that at 3 p.m. on day one of the crisis, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher had issued the following order to her Home Secretary, William Whitelaw.
Absolutely no terrorists will leave the United Kingdom under any circumstances, and not one single hostage will leave the United Kingdom under any sort of pressure.
In the previous episode, I discussed who the terrorists were and what their mission was. Ensuring I deliver balance, I would also like to discuss who the hostages were, as I think their identities are essential to the story of the siege, but also to honour those who lived and died through this crisis. Now, please bear with me as I try to pronounce some of these names. They aren't all in my native tongue, but I would absolutely try my best for you. The hostages were Ghulam Ali Al-Frus, who was the embassy chief d'affaires, Shiraze Boruman, the embassy secretary, Chris Kramer, a BBC sound engineer, Ahmad Dadgar, a medical advisor, Abdul Fazi Izzati, who is an Iranian cultural attaché, Abbas Falahi, the embassy doorman, Muhammad Hashi Furao, who is a British-Pakistani editor of Impact International magazine, Ali Gul Gan Zafar, a Pakistani tourist, Simeon Harris, also known as Sim, who is a BBC sound recorder, Nushin Hashimanian, an embassy secretary, Roya Kagochi, the personal secretary to Ghulam Ali Al-Frus, Hayech Sanai Kanji, an embassy secretary, Mustafa Karkuti, a Syrian journalist, Vahid Kabaz, an Iranian student, Abbas Lavasani, the embassy chief press officer, Police Constable Trevor Locke, who is a Metropolitan Police officer, Mutaba Memovad, a carpet salesman, Abtulib Jusverdi Magadam, an Iranian attaché, Muhammad Moheb, an embassy accountant, Ronald Morris, the embassy manager and chauffeur, Frida Mazafarian, an embassy press officer, Issa Nagzadeh, the embassy first secretary, Ali Akbar Samdazeh, a temporary employee at the embassy, Ali Ashgar Tobatambay, a banker, Kajuri Muhammad Taghi, an embassy accountant, and Zahra Zoramodian, an embassy clerk. Hopefully I didn't butcher those names too much. The officers in charge of the crime scene were Superintendent Fred Luff and his boss, Deputy Commissioner John Dello. Well, they were having trouble initially understanding the wants of the terrorists. Most hostage takers are relatively direct and clear with their demands, the two men thought. But this group seemed to be taking a building and its occupants hostage thousands of miles away from the people and country that it wants freedom for. Dello sent the terrorist document of demands by police courier to the Home Office. Let them worry about the politics of it, he thought. Around 6 months previously, on the 4th of November 1979, Islamic students armed to the teeth stormed the United States Embassy in Tehran. It was a diplomatic catastrophe for President Jimmy Carter. 52 American citizens, both diplomats and civilians, were seized by the Islamic students and held as hostages. The hostage taking was in support of the Ayatollah Khomeini and his new Islamic Republic of Iran. It was praised amongst the Ayatollah's supporters throughout the country. It was seen as a direct strike against infidel America for supporting the Shah and granting him asylum. The United States was described by the Ayatollah as the Great Satan. As you can imagine, the US didn't appreciate this. The United States authorities demanded the release of his citizens. Iran flatly refused. And in a display of international tit-for-tat, the Iranian government demanded the Shah be returned to stand trial in Iran, and the United States flatly refused. So the US severed all diplomatic ties with Iran in response, and President Jimmy Carter went on national television and called the hostage-taking an act of, quote, terrorism and anarchy. America then responded by sending in a rescue squad that couldn't have been more disastrous for them. The failed 1980 American mission was known as Operation Eagle Claw. The United States Army's Delta Force aimed to liberate all 52 of the hostages in a display of force. But the operation was aborted due to equipment failures, a sandstorm, and a mid-air collision between a helicopter and a transport aircraft. 8 American servicemen lost their lives in what was called by the Ayatollah Khomeini as a, quote, act of God. Ultimately, the hostages were held for 444 days and released an hour after President Ronald Reagan's inauguration as a final fuck you from Iran to Jimmy Carter. The US embassy siege in Tehran was front-page news in the United Kingdom. The British situation at the Iranian embassy in London had to go according to plan, and nothing could go wrong. The world was watching, and the disaster for the Americans in Iran was very much fresh on everyone's minds. Deputy Commissioner Dello questioned the origins of the terrorists. Could their siege be in retaliation for the US embassy siege? Were they American radical hardliners making a stand against Iran with a counter situation? In fact, was it possible that the Iranians occupied their own embassy? Dello knew nothing about the group, and anything at this juncture was possible. When it emerged that the gunmen were actually opposed to the Iranian government, authorities and government analysts began to speculate that they must either be the ousted Shah's supporters or Iraqis, supporters of Saddam Hussein and sworn enemies of the Iranians. As reinforcements and specialist units descended on Prince's Gate, the situation was becoming increasingly impossible for the terrorists. The Blue Berets, who were the Metropolitan Police Marksman Unit, took up sniper positions on the ground and first floors of the Ethiopian embassies, and the fifth and sixth floors of the Kingston House, which overlooked the rear gardens of the Iranian embassy. They immediately set up a series of high-powered rifle positions and had their telescopic sights fixed on the windows and doors of the building. In addition, the Special Patrol Group, who were a mobile tactical unit of 30 police officers, arrived in unmarked blue vans parked at a nearby side street and conducted an in-depth sweep search of the area, checking all parked cars against the police national computer in case of any car bombs. The SPG was used by the UK police to fight violent crime, public disorder and terrorism. They were armed with pistols, riot shields, gas grenades and an unfortunate reputation for using overly excessive force. There was also a 10-man special branch unit on site. They were responsible for national security policy and helping gather intel for the Internal Security Service, known as MI5. Terrorism, on UK soil, was its speciality. All in all, John Dello had a hell of a force at his disposal. The police, army, fire brigade and medical services were also on site in large numbers. 24 doctors and 20 nurses were also at the site, on standby in case the worst happened and medical care would need to be given. Residents and employees within a mile of the Prince's Gate vicinity were all evacuated on the afternoon of day one of the siege. The Ethiopian ambassador, Ayale Walgeorgis, was initially not willing to leave his residence at the Ethiopian embassy next door to the situation. Eventually, after much back and forth, the UK Foreign Office didn't give him any choice. He was quote-unquote politely forced to move to a hotel, at the UK government's expense, of course. The main hostage negotiator for the Metropolitan Police was a man called Fred Luff. Composed and measured, Luff was a perfect man to have at the scene. The terrorists were, up until this point, being neither calm nor stable, so Luff had to tread very delicately. Luff was a committed and devout conservative Christian. He was firmly opposed to any immoral and obscene elements within society. In the 1960s and 70s, Scotland Yard briefly operated an obscene publication squad. Well, Luff headed that unit in 1970, and he targeted many of the famous musicians of the day. He absolutely loathed sex, drugs, and rock and roll. He had organized and headed raids at a Mayfair art gallery, where he confiscated 14 artworks painted by John Lennon. Luff said that the artworks depicted Lennon performing sex acts with Yoko Ono and were too vile to be displayed in public. They would, he said, quote, only degrade the moral values of society and contribute towards total anarchy, unquote. Luff also organized a series of raids on the homes of Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Paul McCartney and Rod Stewart, and a series of celebrity drug dealers with the aim of discovering illegal substances. He was the epitome of the guy who was really fun at parties. Meanwhile, in the embassy, the Group of the Martyr, the terrorist organization, wanted media attention. And by chance, no fewer than five of their hostages happened to be journalists. The two BBC men and the Syrian-born Mustafa Karkouti, but also Muhammad Hashi Farouki, the Pakistani-British editor of the Muslim magazine Impact International. And also Vahid Kabaz, a student correspondent for the conservative Iranian newspaper Kayhan. Three of the Iranian captives were also press officers. By accident, the terrorists had kidnapped a number of people with exactly the right expertise to disseminate their message. What a spot of luck. BBC journalist Chris Kramer approached the lead gunman with an offer. He said that he worked for the BBC, so why didn't he let him call the BBC and pass on his demands? Salim, the lead terrorist, actually considered this suggestion and agreed. Thus, Kramer was marched to a small room on the ground floor that had a telephone. With a machine gun firmly pushed into his back, Kramer was asked to dial his number at BBC Television Centre. A voice answered the telephone and said, quote, "Hello, this is Scotland Yard, can I help you?" You see, all lines out of the embassy had already been rerouted to the police force outside. Kramer, who was shaking, said, quote, "I would like to talk to the BBC. Can you put me through, please?" "No, I can't do that. What do you want?" replied the policeman, assuming he was talking to a terrorist. "This is Chris Kramer of BBC Television News. Get me the BBC." "No, I can't do that." The policeman at the other end asked Kramer if he could pass on any vital information. Kramer took a huge risk at this point and said something pretty stupid. Quote, "Well, I just want to say that the 20 men and 6 women being held here in the Iranian embassy are safe and well," and Salim cut off Kramer and flew into a furious rage. "You trick me. You trick us all," Salim shouted. "Just get out." Kramer was forced upstairs at gunpoint and thrown into the general office with the rest of the hostages. He was extremely lucky he wasn't executed. But now the police knew the exact number of hostages. The first media reports about the situation emerged within the first 90 minutes of the crisis. The first report was from LBC Radio Bulletin at 1 p.m. A reporter for them had been stuck in traffic at Prince's Gate due to the redirection of the traffic and road closures. He sensed something big was up and abandoned his car and began asking questions of the police at the scene. Some caved in and gave him the vague information that they had at that point. That LBC News report stated the following, quote,
"A policeman is being held hostage at the Iranian embassy in London. It's understood that a man armed with a rifle walked up to the policeman who was guarding the embassy and forced him inside. I gather he's not English. It has all the appearance of a siege."
This first report was vague and didn't have much information, but that would begin to grow as a media frenzy erupted. Reporters and camera crews descended en masse at the scene. The police insisted that all press were located in a designated area. It was a fenced area in Hyde Park, on the corner of Exhibition Road, roughly 200 yards west of the embassy. At 2:05, Salim placed a call to the police negotiators. "Get me a doctor," he said. He explained that one of the hostages, a woman, was ill and needed medical attention. Frida Mazafarian was an embassy press officer. She was incredibly weak and vomiting. Some of the other hostages had told the terrorists that she was pregnant and having contractions. She wasn't pregnant, just terrified. "We need a woman doctor," Salim said. The police negotiator told him to hold on while he spoke with John Dello, the commissioning officer. Dello thought that a doctor could be taken hostage if he went inside the embassy, so he refused the request. "This request should be used as a bargaining tool," Dello commented. Salim returned to the hostage room and bluntly announced, "We are doing our best to get a doctor, but the police are saying no. Obviously, they don't give a damn about any of you." At 3 p.m, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher assembled an emergency meeting of the Cobra Committee. COBRA was an acronym for the Cabinet Office Briefing Room and was referred to as COBRA. The committee convened in times of national crisis. The committee included top officials from the Home Office, Foreign Office, Police, Intelligence Services, MI5 and MI6, the Army Special Forces, and of course, the Prime Minister. The COBRA Task Force met in the Cabinet Office at No. 70 Whitehall, which was located directly behind No. 10 Downing Street. At this first COBRA meeting, all eventualities and options for resolution were discussed. Thatcher was again firm on her denial of the terrorists leaving the country, taking any hostage out of the embassy and ultimately giving in to their demands. It was times like these that earned her the reputation as the Iron Lady. President Jimmy Carter and the US government were watching the crisis unfold very closely, keen to see how the Brits dealt with a hostage situation similar to theirs and how the Brits would rescue the hostages after their own attempt at a rescue of their citizens had recently ended in an unfortunate outcome. The Prime Minister and Home Secretary William Whitelaw raised this in the COBRA meeting too. If another rescue attempt went wrong, the West would be humiliated once again, which would strengthen the Ayatollah's rule in Iran and his international influence. Thatcher commented that if the Iranian diplomats in London could be rescued, it could be used as leverage to liberate the American hostages and support our good friends in the United States. The SAS director, Peter de la Billière, was among those at the COBRA meeting. He later went on record to describe the meeting with the following quote.
She was impressive. Her power and ruthless, steadfast determination was clear for all in the room to see. She set the overall direction and plan of policy and left it to Whitelaw to execute. As always, the Iron Lady made her opinions abundantly clear. She was not going to allow the gunmen to walk free. She was completely prepared to put hostages' lives at risk in her determination to defeat the terrorists.
Meanwhile, Doreen Locke, the wife of hostage PC Trevor Locke, was just about to leave the house to go shopping when she received a telephone call from a friend. "Have you heard the news?" she said. "No. What's happened?" Doreen responded. "They've taken a PC hostage at the Iranian embassy. They've either shot him or are going to shoot him, and I think it's Trevor." Doreen fell to the floor. She immediately sent all six children to stay with their grandparents around the corner and told them what was happening. The grandparents kept the children away from the television and ensured that they were constantly busy so they wouldn't find out any details about their father. The police arrived at Doreen's door at 2:30 p.m. "Has his gun gone?" Doreen asked. "Has he lost his gun?" The two police officers were reassuring, though deliberately misleading. "He doesn't have his gun. Don't worry about it." The police set up yellow tape between the lampposts outside the Locke's house on Worley Avenue. "Don't answer the door to anyone but the police," they said. "We expect journalists to arrive very soon." All Doreen could do was sit on the sofa and watch the news, her attention firmly fixed on the live television feed. Back in the embassy, some of the hostages had asked for pens and paper, and the terrorists allowed it. They wrote letters to their loved ones. Chris Kramer wrote to his parents.
"Dear Mum and Dad, this seems most strange sitting on the floor here, in this strange office in the embassy, writing to you. Just think, I had no particular reason to come here this morning. Another few minutes and I would have been out of the place. My feelings now are difficult to describe. I'm obviously frightened, but I figure the gunmen are as well. None of us is saying much, really. God knows how this will all end. All I can think about is when I can tell the lads in the bar when this is all over. The trouble is I can't see an end to it. They have their demands and we know that they will never be met. I think the reason I'm writing this is to say that I love you all deeply, although I've probably not showed it too much. I know how really good you have been to me always. Please take care of all yourselves. I am thinking of you the whole time. God bless. Chris."
Kramer folded the paper into a small square and tucked it into his wallet. If he was killed, the police would find it, he thought.
Chapter 4. Negotiations.
At 3:30 p.m., there were raised voices coming from outside. Fred Luff was stood on the pavement with a concealed recording device under his shirt and sweater.
Who are you?
Shouted Salim from a first floor window.
I'm the police officer in charge of negotiations with you. You may call me Mr. Luff.
In turn, Luff asked Salim who he was.
Mr. Luff, I am Salim. We apologize to you and people of your country for this intrusion. We mean no harm to you or to any of the hostages, and I promise that no harm will come to any of the British people in the embassy. We have no argument with your democratic country. I promise you that this is the case.
Salim, I'm pleased to hear you say that. I can promise you that no harm will come to you whilst your hostages are safe. Do you understand?
Mr. Luff, we have no argument with you. Our protest is against Khomeini,
Salim said in return. But then Luff pushed his luck.
Will you please allow my officer to come out now, Salim?
He is all right, and we promise you we will release him. He will not be harmed, but he must stop with us for a while.
But Luff continued to push.
Salim, if you have no quarrel with us, the British people, why do you not prove it by releasing all the British hostages?
So, in kind, Salim clarified.
Look, there is no difference between the British peoples or Iranians. No harm will come to any of them. But you understand we will kill them all if you attack us.
I'm sorry to hear you say that. If you have a political message, it will be destroyed if you kill one hostage, British or otherwise.
But Salim was shaking his head out of the window.
There is no difference between British and Iranian hostages. They are all people. You are lying, Mr. Luff. You are trying to trick us.
At that exact moment, three armed police from the forward response unit were maneuvering a large mirror into position. The mirror was so that they could observe the front door without being shot at. This blew Luff's negotiations as Salim erupted in anger. He slammed the window shut and drew all of the curtains in the front-facing windows. Frida Mazafarian had regained consciousness, and she was now crying and screaming. Salim could see that she was ashen and looked gravely ill. Look, you won't do your cause any good by hanging on to a sick pregnant woman, PC Trevor Locke said to Salim. At 4:10 p.m., Fred Luff called again from outside, and Salim returned to the window.
Salim, I have conveyed your message to my senior officers. I've told them you don't intend to harm the hostages. Why don't you let us give you a telephone connected directly to the police? Then you'll be able to communicate directly with the authorities.
But Salim bluntly refused.
I do not trust you, Mr. Luff. You have tricked us. You have surrounded us with armed men. You are going to attack us. We are prepared to die, but I tell you, if you shoot any of us, all the hostages will die.
Look, Salim, we are not going to attack you. I wouldn't be standing here like this if that was true, would I? You have my word that we won't attack whilst the hostages are safe.
But Salim cut him off.
We are going to release a sick hostage. This is a humanitarian act and should not be seen as weakness.
And with that, Salim slammed the window closed once again. At 4:20 p.m, Roya Kagachi finally convinced Salim to release Frida Mazafarian. Roya pushed that Mazafarian was so terrified that she was about to give birth prematurely on the floor. Shiraza Boroman, the embassy switchboard operator, and Roya dragged Mazafarian down the two flights of stairs and to the front door, where Salim partially opened it, enough for Mazafarian to squeeze through. She staggered out, screaming for help. Two policemen rushed forward and led her to a waiting ambulance. The commander of 22 SAS Regiment, Lieutenant Colonel Michael Rose, had left Bradbury Lines ahead of the rest of the team. He had gone on ahead to London to meet with Deputy Commissioner Dello and walk through what SAS involvement and ultimately a strike by the team would look like. At 3:30 a.m. in the darkness of the early hours of May 1st, the SAS teams moved into number 14 Prince's Gate, the building next door to the embassy. They entered unnoticed by not just the terrorists, but many of the police and emergency services surrounding the area too. The team were then briefed by Colonel Rose's immediate action plan, which would be implemented if the SAS is required to storm the building. As a rough plan, in the early minutes of the Cobra meeting, the afternoon before, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher had stated that if two hostages are killed, then the SAS would go in, no matter what else. One hostage death is unfortunate, but two constitutes a pattern, and we would take that as a sign for their urgent removal. The head of the SAS warned her at this juncture that if the SAS went in, she could expect a 40-60% hostage fatality rate. Thatcher said that that was acceptable in these circumstances. Early in the morning of May the 1st, the gunman ordered one of the hostages to telephone the BBC news desk. Once the call was placed, Salim took the receiver and spoke directly to the BBC journalist at the other end of the telephone. It seemed that not all of the phone lines had been cut. In actual fact, Salim quite shrewdly assumed that the fax lines would still connect to the outside, and he assumed correctly, dialing straight through to the BBC television centre. Colin Thatcher, an editor at BBC Radio Newsreel, was astonished to receive a call at 7:02 a.m. from inside the embassy. On the call, Salim identified his group and made clear that the non-Iranian hostages would not be harmed. He, however, refused to allow the journalist to speak to any of the other hostages. Word had quickly got back to police that the BBC had spoken to the terrorist by phone, and all external lines were ultimately cut from the building immediately. The hostage takers were handed a field telephone through one of the ground floor windows for outside communication with the police exclusively. The field telephone ran on batteries and had a single dedicated open line. Instead of a rotary dial, which was common on telephones in 1980, it had two illuminated buttons on top, a red one, which sounded a buzzer at the other end of the line, and a black one, which was pressed to speak. It was essentially a piece of military field equipment. A long grey cable ran from one end of the phone in the embassy, out of the window, down the street, and up to the top floor of number 24, where it was connected to a loudspeaker in Zulu control, the desk of Commissioner John Dello. When the hostage takers spoke on the phone, the sound played on loudspeakers throughout the command centre for all officers and on-site teams to hear. On the morning of the second day of the crisis, as the hostages awoke from the worst night's sleep they ever had, Chris Kramer, the BBC sound engineer being held, appeared to become seriously ill. He was experiencing severe stomach cramps and was drenched in sweat. It was established that he had recently, on an overseas trip to Zimbabwe, suffered from a particularly nasty bout of dysentery, and the stress of the situation was making the ailment flare back up with a vengeance. Both Kramer and three other non-Arab hostages decided one of them had to get out, and to do this, he had to convincingly exaggerate the symptoms of his illness. Sim Harris, his fellow BBC hostage in the group, was escorted by Abbas to the field telephone to request a doctor. Not unsurprisingly, the police negotiator refused the request for a doctor to enter the embassy, instead suggesting that he try and persuade Salim to release Kramer, like the previous hostage. Subsequent negotiations between Harris, Salim, and the police negotiator team took the duration of the whole morning. But Chris Kramer was ultimately released after he very convincingly led the terrorists to believe that his condition was worsening rapidly. At 11:22, the front door of the embassy swung open and Kramer staggered onto the pavement. Moments later, he was in the back of an ambulance with two anti-terrorist police beside him. He was rushed to hospital, the police trying to gather information from him on the way. Kramer pushed away an oxygen mask offered by a nurse. "I'm not as ill as they think I am," he said. You mustn't storm the building. There are 6 gunmen in there with machine guns and hand grenades. PC Locke still has a gun, Kramer added. Initially, when the terrorists first spoke with the negotiators and provided their statement to pass on to the media, Salim had given a midday deadline of the following day for their demands to be met. As the noon deadline approached, the police were convinced that the gunmen were not able to carry out their threat of blowing up the embassy, and even suspected that the terrorists may waver if pushed. The police negotiators persuaded Salim to agree to a new deadline of 2 p.m. that afternoon. The police purposefully allowed the deadline to pass with no attempts to meet any of the gunmen's demands. There was no immediate response from the terrorists, which the police noted and passed on to the SAS team in waiting in the building next door. Salim then altered his demands throughout that afternoon. He demanded that the British media broadcast a statement of the group's grievances and for ambassadors of 3 Arab countries to negotiate the group's safe passage out of the United Kingdom as soon as the statement had been broadcast. Salim wasn't aware that the UK Foreign Office had already spoken to the Iranian Foreign Secretary in Tehran. It was the Iranians' belief that the terrorists were puppets of the CIA and Saddam Hussein. An American mission to tempt the Iranians to release the US hostages being held in their country. These people are agents of President Carter and the CIA, said the Iranian Minister of Foreign Affairs. These terrorists are Iraqi mercenaries in the pay of the Americans. No prisoners would be released in Iran. No concessions would be made to the treacherous rebels of Khuzestan. You can always count on Iran to read the room. That evening, Salim and Abbas became angry at the noises that they were hearing from the walls. The noises appeared to be coming from the Ethiopian embassy next door. In actual fact, Salim and Abbas weren't going crazy. Next door in the Ethiopian embassy, police technicians were slowly and gently drilling holes in the wall in order to embed listening devices. PC Trevor Locke suspected this may be the case and was quizzed by the terrorists. He denied this would be a police tactic, and that he very much doubted the police would be situated as close as next door. He suggested that the sounds were likely mice within the walls. In reality, there were already several listening devices set up at various positions, and this conversation was already being overheard. Zulu Base, in response, arranged to create ambient noise to cover the light drilling sound. They requested the British Gas Company to loudly drill in the next street over, supposedly to repair a gas main. This quickly pissed the terrorists off, so instead, the British Airports Authority was told to instruct aircraft approaching London's Heathrow Airport to fly over the embassy at low altitude, also creating enough noise to drown out any drilling. Luckily for Zulu Base, and very unluckily for the terrorists, the building they had captured was a foreign consulate, and, of all nations, it belonged to Iran. With relations between the West and Iran deteriorating by the day, it meant that the Iranian embassy was already under heavy surveillance by MI5. In fact, at that point in time, MI5 had all foreign embassies in London under tight surveillance. All telephone and fax lines were bugged and listened to around the clock. There were bugs in most of the rooms, microphones down chimneys, and an array of informants on the staff passing information to the British spies too. MI5 could hear every word from every single room in the building. The agency happily passed this information over to Commissioner Dello in Zulu Base. In addition to the intel, Clifford Jacks, an Essex-based architect whose company had refurbished the Iranian embassy building in 1978, provided Dello with a complete floor plan of the building. The construction and layout was almost a mirror image of the Ethiopian embassy next door. MI5 also traced the company that had installed the central heating system in the building too, along with the district surveyor and the embassy caretaker. Every single inch of the interior, from the stately rooms to cupboards, skylights and bathrooms, windows and doorways, and every single piece of furniture was carefully documented and passed on to the SAS team for preparation. In fact, just 2 years prior, when the building was being refurbished, the Iranian government, then friendly to Britain under the Shah, reached out to British authorities for them to give advice on securing their embassy building. The British government were happy to advise, sending a team of security specialists to advise and guide on the refurb. The Iranians followed the advice down to the T, including ground floor and first floor front windows reinforced with armor-plated glass and a secondary steel security door installed behind the front door. The ambassador's office on the first floor had also been fitted with reinforced walls and steel doors to form a secure interior in case of attack. What the Iranians didn't know was that the security team that the British government sent to help were actually SAS agents, who now would use this information that they gave the Iranians entirely in their own favour. The Prince's Gate crisis quickly became the biggest news story in the world. The media arrived quickly and in droves, pouring into the press enclosure throughout day two. They came from every corner of the globe, foreign and domestic. The American news network ABC dispatched staff from New York, Frankfurt, Beirut, Cairo and Johannesburg. Two-thirds of all BBC news reporters were deployed to cover the siege. Donna Lee, a hungry 21-year-old reporter with a London Evening Standard newspaper, befriended an elderly woman who lived in one of the flats overlooking the rear of the embassy building. The elderly lady was only too happy to allow Lee to set up camp in her living room, giving her a direct vantage point to the drama. Police photographers had dozens of telescopic lenses trained on the building, while 29 snipers kept watch through high-powered rifle sights focused on every inch of the embassy, its windows, doors and roof. Police technicians had set up 17 closed-circuit video cameras with remote-controlled zoom and focus, covering the front and rear of the embassy, the park and the adjacent buildings. The live images were fed to screens inside Zulu Base. Every single figure that appeared at a window or the front door, no matter how fleetingly, had a barrage of camera shutters capturing every inch and every angle of their movement. Every single sighting and person in the embassy, hostage and terrorist, were logged and detailed. Such details as hostage or terrorist, height, build, facial features, complexion, facial hair, hair colour, clothing description, and so on. This information was then passed to both the Met Task Force and also to the SAS to study and memorise the information. Police also had to deal with hundreds of protesters who had converged at the site in rival demonstrations that threatened to deteriorate into chaos and a mass brawl. Racist skinheads, Iranian protesters for the terrorists, Iranian protesters against the terrorists, Christians for peace, Hare Krishnas, and a group of misinformed Americans chanting "Free the American hostages" all clashed, shouted, and hurled both verbal exchanges and in some instances threw items at each other. John Dello at Zulu Base received intel from MI5 just before midday on the fourth day of the standoff. The intel warned of a plot where around 50 young Iranians were planning to acquire lorries, drive them through the police cordons, and assault the embassy to get the terrorists to safety. Whilst the danger of a plot was slim, Dello ordered concrete roadblocks and road spikes along every road leading to Prince's Gate. "We will not let the enemy get the upper hand," Dello said. Thanks for listening to tonight, guys. This is part two of a four-part series. Parts three and four will be dropping this weekend, so keep an eye out for those. Also, if you could take the time to head over to our Patreon and sign up, that would also be hugely welcomed. It's just $2 a month, which is absolutely nothing, and for that you get a ton of extra episodes that we only release over there. We also have blogs, research material, and more. It's a place where we drop episodes that would get censored on any other platform. Head over to www.patreon.com/deadsouls. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.